Bocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Bocelli.
January 20, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is indeed the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me speak really quickly and explain all this. Anyway, it's Thursday, second to last broadcast day of the week for the Bocelli Effect, as per usual, but unusual show planned. And of course, best laid plans of mice, men, and idiots named Bocelli. Here we go. I plan to have a report from Emir, our friend in Ukraine, in the first hour, but turns out I can't get a hold of him just this second. I think he might have his hours back, you know, switched in his mind, although it is a different time of day there than it is for me here. But in addition to Emir and the report from the Ukraine directly that I was looking to get, I also have Larry Hancock with me, who is the author of many books, but tonight's focus is on the one called Creating Chaos. And what does that have to do with? Well, something that is in the news at the moment. And hopefully we'll hear from Amir in the second hour, by the way. But either way, we're going to talk to Larry Hancock. So win-win, can't lose. Creating Chaos, what is that about? What is in the news lately that maybe has something to do with that book that has not done as well as I would have hoped it would have done, because it was well ahead of the curve? What do I mean? You wind up talking about the circumstances involving, a world leader named Vladimir Putin. lots of controversies, lots of different political adaptations, and stagecraft has gone on regarding this figure, especially in the past decade or so. I don't know, higher focus, maybe because he actually, made some media outlets operate under state control quite well. Was able to launch some interesting PR, and I do mean public relations and propaganda campaigns, while attempting to accomplish a lot of goals. And of course, we've heard about Russiagate, we've heard about interference, we've heard about the Russian incursions here and there, what was their role in Syria, all these things in the past few years, but a whole lot more in the past few days. So again, author Larry Hancock's with me, and before he falls asleep on me, because I'm talking too long, let's get to it. Larry, how are you tonight?
Chuck, it's good to be back. I'm doing fine. It's cold in Oklahoma. I hate winter. Other than that, great.
It's kind of cold in Georgia, too, and damp, weirdly damp, like very cold, not quite freezing today, but if it was this damp a day or two ago, we would be covered in ice. It's a weird, weird place. Usually Georgia's not cold, Larry. It's just not. But here we are. Weird weather, not the topic of discussion tonight. So what have we been confronted with in the past few days? Give you the Bocelli bullet points on it, if you like. Here it is. Okay. Is the weather possibly holding up a potential invasion? Oh, wait, I'm getting ahead of myself. Is Joe Biden making statements that are rather confusing and having to be clarified by the administration and the entire diplomatic class of everything Americana at the moment involving Ukraine? Yes. Is there a bit of talk among the Armed Services Committee about what, I don't know, they may or may not do for Ukraine? Why? Because there are, apparently, according to many different reports, troops that are quite a bit present on the border of Ukraine. And I have an independent report from people in Belarus, however it is you want to say it, that says that they have definitely witnessed a serious uptick in Russian military presence in their homeland, and things are going on there that are making some Belarusians, I think that's the best way to say it, maybe Belarusian, I'm not sure. Either way, you know what I'm talking about. Some of those people are getting a little nervous if they're civilians, because they're seeing what they think might be the staging for some military action. Now, Belarus is at the northern border of Ukraine. We, of course, have seen activity in the past about Crimea, which really, honestly, I misread, I feel, in my initial analysis when that was a hot news story. So I'm trying to be careful about this, because there is a lot of rhetoric going on. There is a lot of correction. There is a lot of, well, what is it that NATO's position would be regarding this and that? And the third thing, will they just use sanctions? Any incursion is still an incursion. You have the insistence of the Ukrainian government officials coming out, making statements about Biden's statements. And what does the MSM do? They're giving you lots of reporters in hotel rooms, telling you stories that sound an awful lot like they're just regurgitating official explanations. Not what we're going to do tonight. I'm going to turn to Larry Hancock, who wrote a nice book on this well ahead of the Russian controversies of recent years, kind of again ahead on his timing, unfortunately, in a book that should be selling way better than it is. Creating Chaos. So, Larry, first, a little summation about what the point of the book Creating Chaos is. Of course, I know the answer to this question. I just want him to do it. And then let's get into how this relates, what you wrote a couple years ago, how this relates to what's happening today.
Creating Chaos is really a study in political warfare. It's a study, a twofold study in political warfare. It's a study of how the United States conducted political warfare during the Cold War era, and it is an analysis of how Mr. Putin is conducting political warfare in what is clearly turned into the Second Cold War. It's, as you know, Chuck, I've written other books on covert warfare, conventional warfare. This was kind of trying to pull back and say, literally, how is political warfare different? Because sometimes it does involve some level of military action. But what Creating Chaos is really about political warfare the way the CIA conducted it for two, three decades under Truman, Eisenhower, etc. And then it's a study of how it's being carried out by Mr. Putin today in this century. And it does have conventional military elements to it, which is what we're seeing in Ukraine. But I think just to kind of set the context, successful political warfare the way the CIA or the KGB, and of course that's where Putin comes from, that Putin's whole being was formed in his KGB experience. You use military warfare for intimidation. You don't deploy huge numbers of conventional troops normally. You might put a task force offshore. You know, Eisenhower sent task forces off various foreign nations that we were trying to destabilize and do regime change in, or Putin may deploy huge forces off Ukraine, and including probably the scariest thing of the last 24 hours, and somewhat of a surprise to me, is how much he's upped the ante by actually sending several battalions of intermediate range ballistic missiles right up to the Ukrainian border. And the only purpose for those sorts of missiles would be to conduct a preemptive strike and literally take out all of the command and control and governmental infrastructure of Ukraine. Him deploying regular army regiments, special forces regiments, tank groups, landing craft, they did that before. This is something new. He's really upping the ante. But the bottom line in the book is a study of how you conduct political warfare. And the goal of all political warfare really isn't to overrun countries with conventional forces. It's to change regimes, which is indeed what Putin is intending to do. And if you look at the latest stories out today, we know that. He knows that. Basically, he's trying to put the oligarchs, his oligarchs, in charge of Ukraine, which is what he tried to do back during Ukrainian elections before, and he failed at that, which has really made him mad, and he still wants to do that. So kind of a short introduction to the book and what's going on now.
Fair enough. Now, look, nuance is important here, because the idea that, and I know that this has made some headlines, of course, there are Ukrainian officials which have now been sanctioned who are supposed to be Russia friendly, and all of this. But this is political puppetry. This is very little consequence in the minds of people who might be concerned about the fact that assets like weapons are being deployed. But in context. It would be a sort of a, I don't know, kind of a self-defeating thing for him to absolutely try and obliterate the Ukrainian government, even with a surgical set of, say, small nuclear strikes, if that was the case. I think it might contaminate the land, which would be in a bad spot, considering that they've already taken control of Crimea, which, if you look at the map again, puts Ukraine in a rather inconvenient place to be contaminated or otherwise wounded by nuclear weapons, at least in my mind.
Yeah, and I think what we have to do, you kind of hit on this. This is my best guess, after having now studied Putin for a decade and his actions over a decade. Putin is a great one for theater and weapons theater. I mean, Putin is the guy who has actually develop a nuclear torpedo that is referred to as a continent killer. And in his press conferences, military has said, we just launched this at a distance to the American East Coast, and it will take out literally, it's a hydrogen warhead weapon that will crumble its coastlines, flood, you know, a quarter. It's a continent killer.
Right.
He has actually developed and tested a nuclear-powered cruise missile, which we considered during the Cold War, and after looking at it, A, everything it flies over is contaminated, mm-hmm. and B, in terms of destruction, these are showcase weapons. These are for intimidation.
Yes,
you know,
now
they're not really effective weapons. So this is a guy who does weaponry theater.
See, now, this is an important part, right? So I want to slow you down just a minute here. You got to consider that there is the practical concern. Listen, a continent killer. I mean, you know, what are we talking about here? Yeah, that is intimidating just to think about it. I mean, there is the conventional or practical application of weaponry like this. And then there is just the use of it. I mean, whether it actually works or not, we do not actually know because nobody's killed a continent with it. But up until that time, the assumption has to be made that that capability is there, or maybe it doesn't. Now, in reacting to things like that, adversarial nations to Putin's regime have to consider and make a lot of calculations here. And while you're busy with that, there's the propaganda operation, which is in full swing. There is never a single prong to these movements, is what my point is. And it is a lot of calculation that is being oversimplified, I would say, in our media for the most part. And I don't think they understand necessarily that, you know, placing troops somewhere is not just invade or don't invade. There is a level of intimidation. There is a level of, well, you cut off commerce. There is, you know, again, a lot of just 3D sort of things, you know, real world, physical world kind of problems that come from hostile actions. And then there's the game that can be played here with the legitimate threat of hostile actions. And you need to parse that out, right? I mean, because trying to consider this, and like I said, I mean, I'm watching these people on the MSM, and it's just all about the, you know, the two gunslingers here, one of them being, God help us all, Joe Biden, and the other one being Vladimir Putin, who I would say would be the more skilled gunslinger, and apparently the more skilled propagandist, because there's no confusion in his messaging. And then you have to take a look at what it is we've been allowed to know from Ukraine as far as their officials, their statements, their posture, what it is they're reacting to in a real world way, and are they attempting to rattle a saber? You know, you have the tweet from the Ukrainian president trying to remind people that no incursion into a nation is a small one, first of all, and he's speaking to the, you know, nations that have power. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but effectively this is what he did. The nations that have power, and he's speaking as someone who does have power. I found that a really interesting statement to be made in English, to be made in public, and this could actually have multiple purposes. There could be multiple signals being sent. And in fact, there are probably signals being sent back and forth between the American diplomatic corps and Putin's people. No matter how you want to describe them, the minister of this or whatever, it's kind of irrelevant. Putin's people versus the people in the West, and the rather confusing, seemingly confusing, responses from not only NATO, but the U.S. on its own, the ideas being floated around about, well, let's disrupt their gas line, maybe. Let's sanction them some more, because that's done a whole lot of good. I mean, a lot of things are being played out here. And indeed, financial sanctions are another element and another part of the, again, multi-pronged approach to political, military manipulation. You see what I'm struggling with here, Larry? Maybe you can help me out a little bit here and try and explain that, simply because on the face of it, it appears as though there is a threat of invasion. It doesn't necessarily mean that invasion is the actual goal, but at the same time, invasion might be something that's in play depending on circumstances that emerge, because one thing Putin has proven over the entirety of his public life is his ability to adapt and change, even when he has been unsuccessful, not simply banging his head up against the very same wall. He'll just reorganize and go at it again. I mean, at least that's my impression. What are your thoughts here?
Well, yes, he has the advantage. Putin has the advantage over Biden because the aggressor always has the advantage. I mean, let's face it. Let's put it in historical context. Who had the advantage in the early years, 1938 through 1940 in Europe? Hitler had the advantage over Chamberlain. It's easy to make Chamberlain look like an idiot because Hitler knows exactly what he's going to do. He understands his motives. He understands his constraints. And everybody else is trying to figure out exactly how far he's going to go. Putin holds the same advantage. So it's I think Biden's making some mistakes, but you have to expect that's just the way it's played. The other thing that I think everybody is missing is, as we've discussed before in discussing creating chaos, Chuck, Putin has always, and I document this over and over again in the book, he has always documented what his objectives are, and we just fail to write them down and pay attention. Putin's goal is to recreate a sphere of influence. He wants to have his oligarchs, and he really wants to reconstitute the Soviet sphere of influence throughout Eastern Europe. He did it in Georgia. Georgia is an excellent example of what's going on in Ukraine. What happened is there were a series of, after the fall of Soviet Union, there were a series of increasingly open elections. Open media, open elections, actually some constraints on cheating in election, open vote counts, vote monitors, all the sorts of things we're busily doing away with in the U.S., but that's another story. And this spelled trouble for the regimes, the former Soviet Republic regimes, which, quite frankly, had all been ruled by people that the KGB had put in place. And in Georgia, this happened. Georgia became open enough and transparent enough to really challenge Putin. So what did Putin do? Putin invaded. Didn't invade all of Georgia. He just invaded some territory that was Russian-speaking, more Russian culture, and demonstrated to the leadership in Georgia that, you know, he was prepared to do that and essentially regain political control over Georgia. Nobody gets elected in Georgia now that is not sanctioned out of Moscow. About 4 years ago, Putin effectively tried the same thing in Ukraine. And I go almost month by month through that whole process. It didn't work, and it really irritated him. So what he did then was to turn to destabilization and try to destabilize the new regime by sending forces in and helping create a series of autonomous regions in eastern Ukraine, because if intimidation doesn't work, okay, what you do is destabilize regime and prove that it's fragile, and prove that it's, you know, it gives you a chance. So he did that, and I thought it would work in the Ukraine the same as it had in Georgia. It did not. Mm-hmm. Ukraine really pushed back, took huge losses, and again, the media is totally failing to cover the depth and degree of losses that the Ukraine has already suffered in combat with Russia. Thousands and thousands of troops, entire armored regiments. Ukraine had a very large military during the Soviet era, and they were prepared to fight back and did. And so combat, it's almost like we in the West don't understand that Ukraine has been in a state of combat for years,
right,
with Russia. And That's all described in the book as well. But that just didn't get covered. All that gets covered is new troop buildups on the border.
Well, let me
summarize
on
all of that, Chuck. I guess I would just say,
sure,
I see that you're totally right, and a lot of what's happening is simply intimidation, and it's covered for a political warfare initiative for Putin to get his people to take control in Kiev. Not his, you know, Russian people, but his surrogates, because that's the way both the CIA and the KGB always worked in regime change.
Well, of course, you put a Ukrainian in there that's friendly to you, and that way you can control it. I get it, you know, if you're Putin. But another thing not covered, not even mentioned, again, by all these talking heads, I'm telling you, heads of state departments, you know, former Obama, this, whatever, the Ukrainians have lost territory already. It's not like they didn't lose territory, and there hasn't been an off and on situation here for years, as you said, and they've lost territory, men, they've lost a lot of things. And see, that's the thing, I wanted to get Amir to talk about that, because he'll tell you that, you know, pretty much they had to surrender part of the country, people lost their homes, all kinds of things. Nobody talks about that. They keep saying if the Soviets take some territory, not the Soviets, if the Russians take some territory. I was thinking about my next question. If the Russians take some territory, I'm like, they already have. And, you know, this went on during the Trump administration still. This went on during the Obama administration. This went on during the Bush administration. I mean, slowly but surely, it seems like this has been going on. Maybe I'm off a little bit, but my next thing is the one accurate thing that they do throw out in the MSM is, you know, Vladimir Putin would like to reconstitute the Soviet, they don't say Soviet sphere of influence, which is more accurate, and that's the terminology you use. They just say that he would like to reconstitute the Soviet Empire. I don't think so. Actually, I think Putin would like to get that Soviet sphere of influence, and it is the Russian Empire. It definitely has a different modus operandi than the old CCCP. You know what I'm saying? There is a different... Totally, yeah, go ahead.
Totally different. Yeah, Russian, we should be... It, and two things strike you there. One thing, as you just said, this has been going on. This is the third administration for this to be going on. The advantage Putin has is he's still there. He's been waging this same campaign through three American administrations, which shows you the imbalance. You know, he's got a very concrete objective. He just keeps pursuing it. We have to react every time the administration changes. But the second point is, yeah, he wants to. And here's the strange thing. Here's the thing that kind of baffles me. If you think about it, and somebody put it in very good perspective, aside from its nuclear arsenal, Russia is not really a major power. Its economy, I mean, it's a large oil and gas provider, which makes it significant, kind of like Saudi Arabia or, you know, Venezuela. But its economy is comparable to New York State. You know, it's not a huge, it's not in the same ballpark as many of the European powers. So it's... Putin, the strangest thing is he has every opportunity to leverage his oil and gas reserves with his primary customers, who would be Eastern and Western Europe. But the throwaway is he tried to do that in what's called, the initial, when he was president, his first round friendship initiative, when he courted Western Europe. And just really wasn't treated as well. It wasn't treated badly, but as well, because they were slow to respond. And then he shut off all their gas and oil during winter, cut the pipelines from Ukraine, shut everything down to Western Europe. And Western Europe suddenly realized that, you know, no, he's not a friend. He's a friend as long as you're doing what he wants you to do. And that was a misstep. But now he's gone totally the other direction. Why in the world does it make any sense if for him to forsake his economic, his natural resource advantage, by essentially intimidating and threatening, making nervous what his best customer should be. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense unless his real primary goal is back to that sphere of direct influence and control over politics. I mean, he could control, to some extent, Western Europe with oil and gas, but he's not choosing to do that, which is reveals his baser motive, actually, to me at least.
Well, and it's a curious thing because, again, the sphere of influence is not that of a superpower. However, you have to consider the sensitivity with which you have the second largest, according to some of the statistics I was reading earlier, the second largest producer in the world is Russia, right? So, you know, you ask the people in Germany if they would be a little disturbed about whether they cut off a pipeline, they'll give you a different answer than I would. Of course, a lot of these statistical things are funny because the U.S. is the largest producer. And depending on how you read the statistics. So it's not a matter of he's got the economy that is such a monster that makes him an economic superpower per se, but he's got a very sensitive choke point that he can utilize, and he doesn't have to. Now, he learned the hard way. It's not necessarily the best way to go, although it does make people pay attention. But here we go. It's a curious position, and meanwhile, that position has grown. It is not something that has dwindled in any way over the past decade easily. Now, maybe I went too far back when I went into Bush as far as situation, but still, three administrations, that tells you something. Plus the fact that, you know, there's this whole game that goes on where he's, what is he, the premier, the president, then he's the whatever else. I forget the technical terms, but one way or the other, he's one of the two heads of government, and he keeps getting in and out of each of those positions. And I think there was actually a referendum recently to let him just stay there. You know, mm-hmm. I'm
that's
just saying,
pretty much it.
Yeah, over time, though, I know I'm doing like the very street level explanation of this, but over time, he has really aggregated his power over the Russian Federation, first of all, and simultaneously, he's increased his importance on the map, no matter what. Even if he's not a superpower, he's definitely someone who can wield some serious influence, still not quite up to the level of the old Soviet system. But he's on his way, and it's not, I don't see it slowing down at all. And of course, over time, you know, he will play the long game. He doesn't have to accomplish things in 4 years, right? So, you know, he has that advantage. And then, additionally, you know, exerting control, not really needing the will of the people necessarily to continue on with his agenda. He has time to play the much longer game. And it's interesting how people debate the different, you know, what should we support the Ukraine with? There's talk, as a matter of fact, I think there was a demand even for Patriot missile batteries, which I find almost hilarious in sort of a sad way, because I don't think that's going to do Ukraine any good in a conventional invasion. But at the same time, we've also been treated to the idea, which disappeared fairly quickly, that there could be false flag attacks and things like this that could go on, smaller operations that would do what? Over time, just weaken Ukraine strategically? I mean, is that what we're looking at here, Larry? And do we have a historical basis to believe that this is the playbook of Vladimir Putin or not?
Yeah, well, we can see it. We can see it, and I think the word is that we're missing Putin's playbook. Again, let's go back. Let's go back to the CIA. Let's remember his primary goal is political war. His primary strategy is political warfare. His primary goal is regime change, regime control. What he really wants is he wants leaders in all of those former Soviet republics who owe him, who owe Russia, who will do financial deals that are good for Russia, who will conduct their foreign policy in line with Russia's foreign policy. That's what he wants to replicate. So that's where he wants to go. We should just kind of, does he really need territory? Does he really need to occupy Ukraine? No, he's occupied Ukraine enough. Now, that doesn't say that he won't, but that's not what he really needs. What he really needs is his people in Kyiv, just as he's now got his people in Belarus. That's what he wants. And I go through one by one in the book, Creating Chaos, how he's tried to carry that out with every former Soviet republic. Now, how does he do that? How does he really make that happen? Most of these folks, quite frankly, as the Ukrainians have expressed, if you took a vote, if they took a vote, which would you prefer? Would you prefer the Russian culture and government or Europeans' culture and government? They lean towards Europe. And the current leadership in Kyiv has read their statements. They find that more open, more, it's what they want. That's what he's really fighting. So he's got to, A, destabilize their regimes, and to the extent that he can, he has got to destabilize NATO and literally prevent NATO from any coordinated action against him. Now, that's not just military action, you understand. That means one of the things that triggered this whole thing about 6 years ago now was not NATO per se, but a whole series of financial and investment agreements with Western Europe, where Western Europe was starting to put money into these nations. As a counter, of course, Russia offered money, but they didn't have as much money available. That was what really triggered it. That was like, well, wait a minute. Western Europe, and even some of the new Eastern, Poland, these folks have more successful regimes, more financially successful. That's a risk. So he doesn't want to destabilize just Ukraine. He really wants to destabilize NATO, which he was very successful in the last administration. Mm-hmm. Biden was starting to rebuild a little bit of, well, not just a little bit, more of that before he made this gaffe day before yesterday, which was a real problem. But the whole trick is to make the Western European nations nervous and to separate them from each other in terms of any coordinated pushback, whether it be economic, political, military, or whatever, which is why you see something that we haven't talked about, which is actually just as threatening as those troops on the border, and that is this new surge of unidentified high-performance drones over Finnish, Norwegian nuclear plants, why the series of cutting undersea cables in the different Nordic nations, the series of high-level troop transport movements around, in and around the, again, Norwegian, Scandinavian nations. This is part of his program. It's not just Ukraine. We're missing the boat that his, as a preeminent strategist, he is targeting all of Western Europe to make it nervous. Well, and it's just easier to start in the north.
Right. And I wager that there is a silent campaign right now in Poland to cause issues that no one has recognized as of yet. I wager that. It is speculation on my part. I have no publicly available reports to tell me this, but I'm watching that Poland is having some issues. Now, when we consider what happened with Crimea and the, you know, in air quotes, annexation that they called it, it's really fascinating because it was sort of sold in the West as, well, this is what the Crimean people wanted. And that was true, you know, according to some people. And, you know, I stand very much corrected because I thought maybe that was true. Seemed as though there was, you know, sources out there that that agreed with that idea, that it made a lot of sense, you know. And this is the curious thing. I'm waiting for that to be the big push here. Maybe not with Ukraine, because clearly they've shown public resistance all the way around. Their leadership, I think their people have. Now they're reporting in the West that not much is being said about the imminent threat in Ukraine. It's causing some people to speculate that there is no threat above normal. But as I said, this has been askew the whole time because, you know, people want to talk about, okay, well, during the Obama administration, there were problems there, and there were no problems during the Trump administration. And this is like what? The Democratic program. They actually want trouble in the Ukraine and to use it as... listen, Larry, these are not my assertions.
Okay. I understand.
I want you to understand. This is not what I think. But this is how it kind of gets sold. And I got to tell you, if I'm in that part of Europe at this point, I am starting to be on the lookout for the very initial tremors of the earthquake that is to come. Because destabilization, I think, is ultimately the overall plan here, regardless of which part of the map we're looking at. I think that is the best thing, is if he can create a buffer, even, of you know, confused, contradictory nations not necessarily cooperating as they should, okay, and in the meantime collect some of those territories that did belong to the Soviet sphere of influence, I think that's the whole game.
And he just, we have seen, all he's got to do is pick up one every two or three years. I mean, first, he picked up Georgia. He got back all of the Kazakhstan and those nations. Now Belarus is a major gain for him, and Belarus is now as tightly tied to Moscow as any of the former Soviet republics. Major Russian military formations in Belarus. I mean, nobody's talking about Belarus. 3 years ago, Belarus was a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone, like, in 6 months, and nobody cares, nobody notices. But he is having successes. He doesn't have to have it all at once. In fact, it's probably better that he doesn't. But to some extent, Ukraine is a bit of a diversion. He is, one of the things I call out in the book, is he's certainly trying to pick off the smaller ones first. Is Belarus as important as Ukraine to him? Well, Ukraine's kind of a personal thing to Putin because he invested about 2 years of personal campaigning with the fellow that was running for leadership in Ukraine. And essentially, when he lost, Putin lost. So Ukraine's really personal to Putin. But as far as the whole stretch, Latvia and all the way up the east, they're all targets.
No, absolutely true. And the fascinating part about this area of what it is we're talking about to me is that indeed he did lose in Ukraine, lost influence there. It was kind of strange, though, because okay, here, let me just cut straight to the chase, right? it puts in context, if we take a look at what's happening now, it puts in context the whole thing that went on. And I know people are going to say, oh, yeah, it was they were just going after Trump for the impeachment, blah, blah, blah. But now I think we could put that entire situation into another context when you have that newly elected president who was hilarious to me. I mean, this guy was a reality TV guy and everything, right? We could put that sort of change in the government into a new context. And even the whole thing with Trump, I think, now stands out differently because, again, I know that there are some people just starting to argue that this is really part of a Democratic plan. So, of course, Joe Biden wants a less than stable, a confrontational situation in Ukraine, and he's doing this. Again, this is almost the realm of your average conspiracy theory fodder, but the Biden administration, let's say, because, you know, how much Biden has thought this out, I don't know. And if that press conference the other day and even today's statements have anything to say about it, I still don't know. if you look at it, is it a Democratic thing? And then what, Trump gave it a pause? Or, you know, or what? How would you put that in context now? The whole thing where he's calling him up and maybe we'll send the missiles, maybe we won't. Oh, Obama only sent them blankets, you know.
Yeah.
Help me here.
I think what we're seeing, and over the last two or three days, I think, in all honesty, the U.S. military and the State Department and NATO really have begun to get their act together. And I'll give two indications of that. If you look at some of the stuff that the State Department has put out just within the last 24 hours, and you talked about it earlier, identifying those oligarchs and, action against them, some statements about the level of Russian cyber warfare. I mean, Russia started cyber warfare against Ukraine a week and a half ago, massive cyber warfare. And again, that didn't get the visibility that it should have, because that's always the first play. I detail that in Creating Chaos. The first move in their destabilization these days is always cyber warfare, because that's, you make the government look dysfunctional. So the State Department's beginning to do some things like that. And quite frankly, there are indications that we have already started launching counter cyber warfare actions. In fact, probably everybody missed it, but 3 days ago, Russia took into custody one of the guys who did the major ransomware attacks against us last year. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a key that we're beginning to get to some of. And finally, what you've seen this week is with the British shipment of the anti-tank missiles, with the administration approval of quite a range of anti-tank and anti-aircraft weapons going in to Ukraine now. In all honesty, those missiles that I was talking about really aren't, I mean, they're game changers if you want to destroy a foreign nation.
Right.
But the Russians know and are quite well aware that a really well equipped Ukraine has a large army. I mean, it does, and it's combat experience now. And if you give them a lot of portable anti-aircraft missiles and a bunch of portable tank killer weapons, the Russians are going to take ground. They're going to lose big time. And so that's what we're doing now. So that's some sign to me that we finally got our act together. Should we have done that sooner? Yeah, probably. But back to your bigger question, that will constrain, I suspect, Russian military action. They may feel compelled to create a buffer zone, and that very well is a straightforward demonstration they could do, is just link up the Crimea with all of the secessionist, you know, independent regimes that they've set up in the eastern Ukraine. They may well do that. But we finally, I think the tide has turned. Obama should have done that. I mean, Trump thought you could be nice to Putin and he would stop doing whatever he's doing. Obama seems to have thought that Putin has an agenda. We can't seem to get over the fact that his agenda is respective of no one else's.
Well, you know, that's one thing. But the other thing that you brought up earlier, which I'd like you to elaborate about, is the fact that it's no secret the man does lay out what he's going to do. It's just always in hindsight, it appears. does anybody ever catch it and say, oh, you know, he kind of said he was going to do this. So I'd like you to elaborate about that. But also, before we go there, just I wonder if you think there is anything significant, because as I said, I've heard from people in Belarus that that they are seeing a lot of activity, much, much more than they have before. And in the Western press, they've described it as exercises. And I know that this sounds familiar because I know I read about this in your book. You know, not obviously you weren't telling the future, Larry. So, you know, help me out with that. And then also speak to this idea that it's really no secret what's going to go on here. It just does seem strange that, I don't know, almost everybody reacts to this guy as if they don't know what he's doing all the time. Like, we're not sure, we're not sure. And yet he seems to telegraph it pretty well if you look back and you say, he said he was going to do this and he did it. So if you could handle those two things, I'd really love to hear about it. So yeah. Belarus, the alleged exercise. And secondly, the, you know, precognitive knowledge that we should have here, right?
Well, I think, and it's certainly not hilarious, but, and I you had mentioned Crimea, and I think Crimea gives us, Crimea and Eastern Ukraine gives us an insight, and this is totally documented. I'm making none of this up, although you might think I was. Okay, in Crimea, the first Russian initiative into Crimea, Putin's remark was, this was a local revolt in Crimea. Russian had nothing to do with it. We had no forces in Crimea. The people there were just very upset with the central Ukrainian government, and they did this on their own. And we had nothing to do with it. All right. Within a month, he goes on Russian news and is interviewed and says, well, actually, we did send in special forces. And yes, we should be proud of the fact that it was our special forces who acted as the source of the revolt against the Ukrainians. We had to do that. The people wanted it. But yes, and here's the units. We know which units they were, for heaven's sakes. We knew which aircraft carried them into what base. So he admits that he lied before. Okay. Next step, at that same conference, he says, but of course, we're not there to occupy Ukraine. We're not there to make Crimea. We're not there to make it part of Russia. That's not our intent. We would never do that. Crimea will always be independent. 2 months later, after they've had a vote totally conducted by the Russian military, Crimea secedes from Ukraine and joins Russia. About 2 weeks later, Putin has another interview and says, we're so proud. Yes, we had always wanted Crimea to be part of Russia, and we're going to be a great boon to their economy. The man does interviews and will lie, do another interview, tell you he's lied, but he's proud about it, do another lie. How could you think that anything he told you is not situational? And I which is the striking thing to me, is like, did nobody in the State Department write this stuff down and brief anybody? We know he didn't brief Trump because Trump didn't take briefings. But I hopefully they're now briefing Biden. It's sort of like, do not believe anything the man says, because 2 weeks later, after he's done something, he will recant. So I think maybe that answers your question. We do understand Vladimir Putin when we just listen to him. There's really no mystery. Okay.
Right, because let's get to Belarus in a second, because he always leads with, this is the way it is. As soon as he makes a hard statement, better understand a change is coming. It's that simple. I don't understand how they don't have this pattern written down somewhere. The second that he says, oh no, we're going to absolutely not do this, you start looking for him to do it. You might catch it ahead of time, you know?
Yeah, like, let's take that sentence and rewrite it 180 degrees. Okay, yeah. Now we know what he's actually going to do. So that is clear. And that was actually, when I started researching for book, that was kind of the stunning thing to me, is that he has been so consistent in stating his goals, stating his strategy, and telling people what he's going to do. But we all see it's like Putin is a mystery. Who knows what Putin's going to do? Well, we do.
Yeah.
But okay, Belarus. I think two things are going on there. First of all, it's in Putin's sending large forces to do exercises, quote unquote, in Belarus does two things. First, it solidifies the whole of the leadership in Belarus. I mean, that's always that's a familiar gambit. So just having Russian troops there, as well as having Russian forces on call to any leader who is linked to Moscow, is messaging. I mean, it really is messaging to the population, saying whether or not you guys really understood the extent to which you're now affiliated with us. Now that you see this level of military force, you really do understand it, don't you? So it's messaging. That was constant Soviet practice. They did huge exercises with all of their Soviet affiliate states. I mean, that was just a way of messaging. Plus, quite frankly, it allows you to garrison, since those exercises never really end, it allows you to garrison a pretty large-scale force inside the country just in case there is trouble. So that's one part of it. But I think in this instance, that was happening, and they are staging it. If they do, somehow Putin gets convinced. I have a hard time seeing him have there being any value in trying to really occupy Ukraine, but creating a buffer state, compartment. I mean, the Soviet Union was very happy with East and West Berlin,
right?
East and West Germany. Putin would be very happy with an East and West Ukraine if it comes to that. When he first became involved in Ukraine, after he lost, essentially his candidate lost the election,
right,
he started talking, and I forget the exact phrase, but it's a phrase that comes out of Russian empire history, not Soviet history, but the fact that certain geographic areas of eastern Ukraine always were culturally Russian. They spoke Russian. They had Russian values. They were Mother Russia. And he tried to float that to convince a large segment of Ukraine that they really were, you know, Mother Russia was Ukraine.
Well, simultaneously,
most of Ukraine did not buy that.
Right. And simultaneously, that was the propaganda line from Russian state media regarding, guess what? Crimea. That's exactly what that was. Okay. So last question before we break for this hour, and perhaps we will have a second hour. I'm not sure, because still trying to get a hold of Amir. Sorry about that, Larry, but still trying to get a hold of him. But this is a very serious question, and it's a very practical one. Even in the case where you have, let's just say, an East and West Ukraine, we don't even have to go that far, because on the map, the way I'm seeing it, is that you have Ukraine with basically one friendly border at this point. If you were to consider the north, the east, and west, and south, just their four borders, right? I mean, I know it's not a square-shaped nation, but you look to the north, you have what could potentially be a Putin ally for sure. You look to the east, you have a point of contention with individuals that are basically Russian separatists of sorts. You have Crimea, which is now what? Welcomed back into Russia on the east. What do you have? You have the south. And, you know, what are your thoughts about that? That regardless of how the strategies have played out, it is almost foolish to assume that Putin has any other design other than to leverage control, if not take absolute control of Ukraine at this point in time. But he will play the long enough game where maybe they might be suffocated by having no borders to work with outside of the one, if you only consider the four directions. What about that? Sort of strategy?
I think it would force NATO and the U.S. very much, and I didn't bring up the, you know, Eastern Germany, Western Germany. It will force NATO into that position. If he should actually not take the whole thing, but but it start from Bull Run and go try to create an Eastern Ukraine, if you will. I think the only answer to that, if you feel it's worthwhile, is Ukraine would apply to NATO and NATO would respond and would have to defend Western Ukraine just like it defended Western Germany. And suddenly the Cold War is back full swing, which it already is. We just haven't kind of accepted that.
Right.
And rather than the choke point being, you know, Berlin and Western versus Eastern Europe, and we're garrisoning troops all along the line in Western Europe for a Soviet advance, now we're going to be doing the same thing in Ukraine. I mean, that's what it could lead to, because he is, if he just bifurcates the nation and NATO and the West does not respond, he's going to take back a lot of those states unless NATO actually begins to garrison them. Like the three Eastern European nations, former Soviet republics, today have been authorized by the United States to sell anti-aircraft and other weaponry to Ukraine. That would be the foretaste of what would happen. There would be a new, I hate to call it, you know, Winston Churchill used it, I'm not going to use it again, but there would be, Putin's building walls, which he may want, quite frankly, because as we discussed earlier, if he didn't want walls and he didn't want a free market, if he wanted free market access to Western Europe, there's no sense of him doing what he's doing. It just makes no sense. So clearly he wants borders.
Fair enough. Creating Chaos, give us the whole title there, Larry, please.
Oh, goodness gracious. Chuck, you expect I really remember that? gee whiz.
Look, it's okay.
A dozen books and he wants the full title.
It's okay. You know what? Perhaps your wife will remember it because she usually helps you with the titles too, right?
Yes.
Either way. Look, guys, Creating Chaos, it is one of the wonderful books by this incredible author, Larry Hancock. And we may or may not have Larry return on the other side of this break. We'll see. If not, though, you've gotten a master class in, well, the behavior of Vladimir Putin and what it is we can expect given the current situation. Anyway, stick around. Something will return after this break on Ocelli.com. Not sure if it'll be me, but we'll see. Thanks, Larry Hancock.
Good to be here.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Ocelli.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination broken into over claims?
Go to Amazon.com, enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite? How do you make them feel as one with you?
With the rails.
Join them first. Join them. Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But most of all, anger is most of all the essence is that you make this mob an extension of yourself.
Revelation through conversation.
So we're going to take just a bit of a pause here and tell you that it does seem as though I can't get a hold of my second guest for tonight. And I will attempt to get in touch with him and see if we can get a full-on interview with him. Emir is a resident there in Ukraine. He's got a bit more of an Aussie accent than anything, but he grew up partially in Australia. He's got an interesting story to begin with, and no matter what's going on, I hope that he is all right. I am not able to get a hold of him, though, and I will attempt to do so later on and let you guys know how that goes, and hopefully I'll be able to have a podcast in two parts. Even if I got to record it late tonight, I will. At Ocelli.com and the facilities thereof. So that'll be that for the live show on the stream for now, but who knows what a little later on will bring.